I wanted to put murdered while doing his duty.
Someone's building a case against you, George. Someone who wants to discredit George Gently.
Do you know how much I hate you, George Gently?
You and Rattigan were in business together, weren't you? And you still are.
He's a lunatic these days. Total liability.
I don't care if it takes 20 years. You're gonna die. By me.
Tonight at 7 on WTTW.
Hello, we're the Vasco's family, and you're watching WTTW.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
Delaying the budget would be a catastrophic for our district.
Will they or won't they? Board members for Chicago Public Schools consider a vote on the district's proposal. A live report on the latest. A one-stop shop for early childhood programs. We sit down with the head of the new State Department. Fires in the last 3 years, why that is, and what's being done to prevent it.
It's really important that young women and young girls also learn to lift each other up.
Softball stars in Mexico who are coming to Springfield to play pro baseball. First off tonight, it's been a long, dramatic, and passionate day at the Chicago Board of Education meeting, where board members are considering voting on a budget proposed by Chicago Public School Superintendent Macklin King for the coming school year. Our Nick Blumberg joins us now with the latest. Nick.
Brandis, it has been a long day indeed, and will they or won't they is still up in the air. We got started a little after 10:30 this morning, and the board is still in there. I had to step out so I could talk with you fine folks, but they are still going back and forth over the budget as proposed by CPS Superintendent Macklin King and her staff. The day started off with King making an impassioned plea to board members, saying it is urgent that the budget passes today. CPS is facing a cash crunch, and if they don't pass this budget and agree to some short-term loans, they're worried they may miss the first check of the school year. So she said it is time to get this done. Let's take a listen to Dr. King.
If we pass a budget today, our finance team expects that they will have funds. They will have the funds we need to make payroll by September 2nd, just 2 days before the deadline. Delaying the budget would be a catastrophic for our district. It would be a de facto shutdown right when students are returning to school. We cannot let that happen.
So after some 30 public speakers, followed by a handful of politicians as well, the board voted to take a 2-hour recess. After coming back from that recess, we heard from some top budget officials going through in more detail the budget that King is proposing, but they are facing some sharp questions from board members. There's been some talk of an amendment to change this budget and assume that some state revenue is going to come through. There's some hope about that, which we'll get to later, but it's no guarantee. So there's a lot of questions about why are we assuming that we're going to get a certain amount in TIF surplus from the city, but not assume that we're going to get a certain amount in additional funding from the state. There's questions about whether passing a budget that some call unbalanced with that amendment would violate the school code, would violate state law. This budget, of course, has been a tough one with a more than $700 million gap. There's a proposal for about 1,600 layoffs, teachers, support staff, a few assistant principals. But King says the goal here is to keep things away as best as possible from affecting the classroom.
And Nick, there's also been a lot of discussion about during this budget cycle about more state funding, as you said, for CPS to help close that budget gap, including advocating for a special session in Springfield. Did they mention that during those discussions today?
Oh, they've mentioned little else, it feels like. King acknowledged the calls for a special session. She says that district leaders are committed to working to advocate funding, that the CPS is due more under the state's own evidence-based formula, but she said it's a mistake to pass a budget to assume more state funding that might not materialize. She recalled when that happened back in 2017, and there were mid-year layoffs and furloughs and cuts, as well as debt that CPS is still saddled with. Here's Dr. King again.
We know, and we will continue to advocate at all levels of government for the funding that our students not only need, but they rightfully deserve. And we also need to learn from our mistakes instead of repeating them. Passing this budget does not preclude us from advocating for additional funding from the state. I am there with you in the fight for more revenue.
But a lot of folks say that doesn't go far enough, including plenty of the folks who are still debating the budget in the boardroom behind me right now. We also heard from Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates at a rally before today's board meeting even got started. Like we said, it's been a long day. Davis Gates says it all comes down to dollars and cents.
Solve this problem, Governor Pritzker. And we know you can. You're a billionaire, and you know other billionaires.
That's right.
And if anyone can organize billionaires on behalf of the people of Illinois, it is our billionaire governor.
And Davis Gates said she doesn't understand how there can be layoffs and slight changes to the student-to-teacher ratio without increasing class sizes. She also pointed out to comments from State House Speaker Chris Welch yesterday, who told the State Board of Education that he would lead the fight for more CPS funding in the fall veto session, but he stopped short of proposing a special session, saying there wasn't necessarily the appetite there. Welch, of course, currently facing his own firestorm over sexual harassment allegations against former state rep Harry Benton, as well as questions about his own conduct toward women. And the speaker said, you know, he might he's going to advocate this for this in the fall, but there is no guarantee. So that's why there is so much pushback right now, so much back and forth right now over the question of whether they should amend this budget to assume state revenue that isn't guaranteed. The debate is not over yet. Brandis, it could be a long evening ahead of us. Back to you.
A lot going on, a lot to figure out. Nick, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Up next, we meet ever Secretary of the Illinois Department of Early Childhood.
WTTW News coverage of policing and police reform is supported by the Joyce Foundation.
Illinois' youngest residents, as well as their parents and caregivers, have a new arm of the state government to turn to for resources. The Illinois Department of Early Childhood officially opened at the beginning of this month after a 2024 law that created it. Now all of the state's early childhood programs are under one roof. And while building a brand new state agency is one thing, planning for federal funding uncertainty and regulatory rollbacks is a challenge all on its own. Joining us to talk about it is Teresa Ramos, the first ever secretary of the Illinois Department of Early Childhood. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to Chicago Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So less than actually 30 days on the job.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about your work, because your department combines the early childhood functions that were formerly under the Department of Childhood and Family Services, DCFS, IDHS, Illinois Department of Human Services, and ISBE, the Illinois State Board of Education, as well as the governor's the office that was in his office of early childhood education. Why do you all think it was necessary to pull all of these together under one department?
Yeah, it was a huge decades-long endeavor, really. We have some of the best advocates and partners across the state who said, we need one place, one person, one agency in charge of programs that have been in three agencies. When you have programs in three agencies all serving families with young children, you have to navigate that complexity. That complexity is borne by providers and families, and we said to make it simpler and better and fairer for families across the state, we need one place to go, a one-stop shop to navigate those services in those earliest years of life.
Folks like you know about the importance of early education and early learning for childhood development. Do you think this new department, its formation, is also a reflection of everybody else sort of going, oh yeah, this is important, we should invest?
I think the governor has long been a champion for early childhood education and care, not only because in those first 5 years of life, 90% of all of our brain development happens. It is where you get the biggest return on investment as a family, to have supports, to set your your child and family up for success long term. But it's also true at the state level. When we invest early, we see that pay dividends in preschool and K-12 and post-secondary and kind of all life outcomes. And so the goal here really is to how do we make sure we can drive equity and efficiency in those services for families across the rich diversity of the state.
What are some of those programs then that now fall under your office?
Right. So those are programs like preschool, preschool for all. We have programs, the Child Care Assistance Program, which provides financial assistance for families from lower incomes. We have early intervention programs, which support families with young children 0 to 3 who might need speech therapists or developmental therapists. The whole kind of kit and caboodle of those services and home visiting that supports families as they are caring for their children from as early as prenatal through the age of 5.
So for parents then, what does this mean if they are, for example, looking for early intervention services or any other sort of services for that matter for their kiddo?
Well, first, we're 30 days in, and I think a marker of our success is if you are a parent and you were connected in those services 30 days ago or 60 days ago, nothing changed, right? You have those services seamlessly. You're still in relationship with the provider, with the family, with the resource that you were before. If you're a new family or you're an aspiring provider now, there's one place to go to get your questions answered, to get connected to the right person, information. Previously, as you mentioned, they were at 3 agencies, DHS, the State Board of Education, DCFS. You had to navigate, who do I talk to if I need this? How can I, you know if I'm getting quality care, if this is licensed, what are my options? Now it's IDEC.
Okay. And then for childcare providers, how does this make life easier for them? I imagine they can apply to one agency for state grant funding rather than 3,
depending
on the grant.
There's a lot of work to do, and we've talked about this transition really as in phases, the work to pass the legislation and get ready to transition what has now hundreds of people, thousands of process, and about 100 technologies over to the agencies. As part of that transition for providers, they were previously applying for funding at the Department of Human Services and also at the State Board of Education. 2 different platforms asking you kind of the same questions. Now we have one platform for managing those grants at the Department of Early Childhood. There is still work to do on designing a more seamless and simplified system for providers. Right now, there are 12 funding streams that come into Illinois that serve providers that they can apply for. Some are competitive, some aren't. Some are vouchers, some are you know, different ways of coming in. We still have work to do with our partners in the General Assembly to say, hey, how can we simplify and ease this burden over time?
On the funding side, how much would you say of your budget comes from these already existing programs, and how much new is being appropriated for the organization's sake, but also any new programming that you're starting?
Yeah, I think we're really lucky in Illinois that we have had Governor J.B. Pritzker in office. Since he came into office, he has added about $1 billion, just under $1 billion, to early childhood education and care services across programs at these 3 agencies. And the agency itself allows us to really say, where are the dollars going? How do we drive equity and efficiency over time so that way more families can be served across the state?
So after a recent federal rule change, states are no longer required to cap co-payments for child care. This and it allows states to switch from enrollment-based funding to attendance-based funding. What does that mean for families in Illinois?
I think we get, questions about what the implications are for federal changes all the time. In fact, a year ago, we stood up a committee as part of our Early Learning Council to say, how do we connect directly to providers and families to understand what any of this uncertainty means for them? What we know now is those changes will make it less affordable and harder to be a child care provider in Illinois. And we continue to work with our partners, providers, families, our sister agencies to understand what we can do to drive more support to providers.
What might that look like if it's going to get harder, and what you all might be able to do to support them?
I think it makes the new department more important than ever before. A lot of the navigation and time spent applying to different funding streams, submitting the same data, going to 12 different people to get a question answered. Now we're starting to ease that. There's one place to go. We have taken a customer service program that was at the Department of Human Services and made it for the whole agency. So if you have a question, we will navigate you to the right answer. It means planning and thinking about how do we start to reform our funding system so it simplifies the administrative burden. Right now, those 12 funding formulas that are coming in and we're navigating means compliance monitoring, evaluation. It means application. It means a lot of heavy paperwork and administration. We can simplify that and making it easier for providers.
Head Start funding has been uncertain during the Trump administration. What is the status of that right now?
Yeah, Head Start is a unique program nationally. It goes directly from the feds to local providers in Illinois, like a Carol Robertson Center, a Start Early, or SAL in the Quad Cities. So the state doesn't have the same role in supporting it. Feds directly give money to providers. That said, we work closely with all of those providers to say, what does a certainty mean? How can we start to think and plan and prepare for, you know, any eventuality in the future?
And of course, Head Start, for viewers at home, for low-income families, provides that early education. You know, 30 seconds left, Secretary. What goals do you hope IDEC will accomplish in the coming years?
Oh, so many goals. I mean, our North Star is we want to be on a path to make Illinois the best state in the country to raise a family with young children. We've said we want to simplify the process for providers to become a licensed provider and stay a provider in Illinois. We want to make it easier for families to get services in those earliest years of their child's life, when they're 6 weeks old to 3 years old. We know we need to modernize and evaluate our operational infrastructure to make all that happen. And so that's what we're going to see over the next couple of years.
All right, 30 days in, more to come.
Lots more to come, yes.
Best of luck to you. Illinois Department of Early Education Secretary Teresa Ramos, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we're back with more right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
A suburban Chicago prison has seen more than 70 fires in the last 3 years, marking three per month in 2025. The Joliet Treatment Center was designed to provide intensive mental health care to inmates. Not even a decade after it's opened its doors in 2017, conditions have reportedly declined. A new report by the Marshall Project details how the frequency of the prison's fires may have been desperate cries for help. Joining us now is Shannon Heffernan, a reporter with the Marshall Project. Shannon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we should also warn our viewers that this discussion will include mention of self-immolation and self-harm. Shannon, first tell us, give us a sense of what the Joliet Treatment Center is intended to do.
Yeah, the Joliet Treatment Center was designed to provide care to people in the Illinois Department of Corrections who have the highest mental health needs. People with mental health needs are overrepresented in the Department of Corrections. And when it first opened, you know, I heard from guys inside that they were really relieved at what was being provided, that they were getting therapy, that they were getting psychiatry, that they were getting time out of their cells. And then that started to decline around 2020, and people became pretty desperate. They report that they weren't getting therapy nearly as much as they needed it. They reported trouble getting physical health care, too. And one of the most difficult things for a lot of the guys that I heard from was that they were being kept in their cells for long stretches of time as their mental health deteriorated. And they did what they could to get attention. They wrote to officials, they talked to officials, and they just kept escalating what they did until they started setting these fires.
So in your reporting, you found that the amount of mental health treatment they were receiving, you said, declined to the point where they began self-harming, setting fires to get any attention. And you tell the story of Jason Steffens. He was 38 when he died from a fire that he set. And we have audio that you all provided of the 911 call that was made by an officer at the prison after he set that fire in his cell. Let's take a listen.
Joliet 911, where's your emergency?
Hi, my name is Officer Harville at Joliet Treatment Center. We need the fire department here. We had an inmate set his cell on fire. I don't know what exactly he set on fire.
Is it still on fire?
We were able to extinguish it from what I can see.
Is there still smoke, though?
Yes.
Okay. All right, and are you guys like evacuating the inmates immediately around him or immediately around there away from it?
We're still dealing with the situation. I can't answer that.
Shannon, what happened?
So after he set this fire, he was left in his cell for nearly 30 minutes, a smoke-filled cell. Officers did go to the door of his cell. They opened a slot usually used to deliver food, and they put a fire extinguisher and pepper spray inside, but they didn't let him out.
And as you're speaking, I just want our audience to know we're looking at video. We can see the flames inside his cell there.
Yes, and the firefighters, when they arrived, one of them reported that department employees did not tell them that Stephens was in the cell. Eventually, they do let him out of the cell. At least they did not immediately tell him. They do eventually let him out of the cell, and he goes to the prison gate. And there at the prison gate, they don't let the ambulance out. They're waiting for paperwork and for correctional officers to follow the ambulance to the hospital, but they're not immediately available. And they wait at that gate for around 28 minutes before the ambulance is finally let through. They're doing that while Stephens is in the back of the ambulance, having air forced into his lungs on a machine, so in really serious condition. And then Stephens died 2 weeks later.
Okay, and of course we know that you found some records showing that the prison cell blocks lacked sprinklers, fire alarms, couldn't produce a fire evacuation plan. IDOC have much to say about all this.
So the Illinois Department of Corrections responded that they care about the safety of people inside and the employees there, but they provided no answers to any of our questions. We also reached out to the governor's office, who just deferred to the Illinois Department of Corrections. So we're really eager to hear answers from the Department of Corrections about what they've done to fix basic things like the fire alarms or what they've not done.
Okay. Great reporting from Shannon Heffernan and your team, of course. Thank you for joining us. And viewers can read that full story on the Joliet Treatment Center. You can head to our website. That's WTTW.com/news. And we're back with more right after this. Women's sports are gaining unprecedented attention and popularity around the world. Softball and now women's baseball are starting to take center field. In Mexico, women's teams filled with Mexican stars as well as former American college standouts are drawing big crowds. In partnership with WTTW News, students from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism went on a reporting trip to Mexico City to explore this phenomenon and meet players who will be playing in the inaugural Women's Pro Baseball League right here in Illinois starting this Saturday.
When you can see someone as a full person, as a full woman on a field, or as a full athlete as a woman, I think it's really cool, and I think that is part of the rise.
Women's softball is on the rise around the world. And here at Estadio Diablos in Mexico City, the crowd is excited to see two top teams face off. Jasmine Jackson is an outfielder for Los Diablos Rojos Femenil, the city's national softball team. They're the reigning champs in Mexico's professional league.
There's a big need for spaces that are only girls or only young women to fail and succeed within their own groups.
Jackson was a Division I athlete for Cal Berkeley, ranking third in program history, but had no plan to go pro. But after competing with Team USA and in the Netherlands, Los Diablos gave her a call.
And I was like, ha, that's very funny. Like, let's do it. Let's go. And then ended up here, and it was like one of the best decisions I've ever made for my entire career.
The Mexican Softball League was formed in 2023 with 8 teams representing cities across the country, making this the first time that softball players in Latin America have had a league of their own.
Me gusta mucho el softball porque en el béisbol sí había como algunos problemas porque era un deporte de hombres, era pitcher, y cuando por ejemplo ponchabas a un niño, era como que burla de que cómo te poncha una niña y que no sé qué, y eso sí era como que un poquito molesto. Y bueno, yo creo que pues me sirvió muchísimo para aumentar mi nivel de juego.
Edith DeLea, third base for Los Diablos, says she never thought this league would exist. But playing pro women's sports was always her dream.
Trabajar en este deporte en donde todas somos mujeres, la verdad es que me siento bastante, bastante feliz de que las mujeres ya se abran su camino y hagan su propia historia.
Good enough to play professional baseball in Springfield, Illinois this summer.
Para mí significa mucho estar en esta liga de Estados Unidos porque fue un sueño de niña. Siempre quise jugar en los Estados Unidos como mexicana, demostrar el talento que tenemos también los mexicanos. Y bueno, primero Dios, llegar allá y demostrar y cumplir muchos logros.
The Women's Pro Baseball League, or WPBL, is the first women's professional league since 1954, taking place in the same city of the first ever paid women's baseball game in 1875.
El que yo llegara a Illinois, a esa liga, fue mediante los torneos panamericanos que tuve con Selección México. Y creo que nada más por ser primera temporada, todos los equipos que son de diferentes lugares van a jugar justo en Illinois.
The WPBL will premiere its seven-week season in August.
Bueno, yo espero que el futuro de las mujeres en el deporte, que nos sigan abriendo muchas puertas, que nos den las oportunidades que nosotras necesitamos para demostrar que también podemos.
Los Diablos play in the same stadium as the men's team, with the same name. And fans show up and show out. According to the World Baseball Softball Confederation, Los Diablos had the highest game attendance of 2025 in the entire Mexican Softball League, with 12,000 fans. But the players say the best fans are the young girls they inspire.
Para mí significa aprender más de todos los deportes que existen.
Me encanta que las mujeres estemos retomando fuerza y que no solo en el softball, en el fútbol, en todos los deportes.
And the players say they hope their success inspires the next generation of female athletes.
And when I can be my best, not because I'm competing with you, but because I just want to be my best, it also encourages others to do the same. It's really important that young women and young girls also learn to lift each other up.
For Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism and WTTW, this is Morgan Hawes and Gabrielle Hayward.
The inaugural season of the Women's Pro Baseball League begins in Springfield on Saturday.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices.
And that's our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow at 5:30 and 7 for Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals. PBS NewsHour, next on WTTW.
This street drove America toward revolution. This street fueled Western expansion. And this street paved the way for the shopping mall. Take a cross-country road trip on 10 streets that changed America.
Friday at 8 on WTTW.
On American Experience.
They died at T-minus 10 minutes, helplessly trapped inside their spacecraft.
The fire shattered my wife's confidence in NASA and in the Apollo program.
The continuation of Chasing the Moon on American Experience.
Friday at 9 on WTTW.
Now streaming on the PBS app from Emmy-winning scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr.
These are your immigrant ancestors.
Discover the incredible history that connects us all. Stream the Henry Louis Gates Jr. collection now on the PBS app.
You've got a team that's called the White Sox, fixing World Series games and defiling the entire sport. It was natural that they would be called the Black Sox.
The Black Sox Scandal on Chicago Stories.
Strike three, you're out!
This is what summer sounds like. Catch Paul Simon, Gladys Knight, Chance the Rapper, and more. Plus the celebration of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's milestone 90th season. Don't miss out on 90-plus concerts, 50-plus debuts, and a new pavilion. Tickets on sale now at ravinia.org.
WTTW programming originates from the Rene Crown Public Media Center. Programming on WTTW is made possible in part by Sandra Holubo, in memory of Fred Holubo.
I wanted to put murdered while doing his duty.
Someone's building a case against you, George. Someone who wants to discredit George Gently.
Do you know how much I hate you, George Gently?
You and Rattigan were in business together, weren't you? And you still are.
He's a lunatic these days. Total liability.
I don't care if it takes 20 years. You're gonna die. By me.
Tonight at 7 on WTTW.
This is very concerning.
According to the deceased's wife, it doesn't belong to them.
Death occurred less than 12 hours ago.
Is it a Japanese suicide dagger?
It's too small to be a samurai.
Having exhausted all legal avenues, every one of them had a very strong motive to want to kill him.
Given his reputation, perhaps he fell on his sword.
Backwards.
Tonight at 8:30 on WTTW.
Hi, my name is Keena Young from the Firehouse Community Arts Center in North Lawndale. And you're watching WTTW. Woo!
Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, U.S. attacks on Iran ramp up as the war expands across the region.
The U.S. economy slows. How the Federal Reserve's new leadership is likely to respond to economic pressures on multiple fronts.
And Israeli settlers escalate attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank.
All of the West Bank is surrounded, whether cities, villages, or towns. There isn't a place without settlers surrounding us everywhere.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by
Economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.